Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. It's Wednesday. It's August 10th. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. I'm so pleased to be able to speak today to Professor Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. He's a socioeconomic research scholar. He operates his own website called Labor Econ, L-A-B-O-R-E-C-O-N. And you could easily find him online at www.econlabor.com. And it's always a pleasure to speak to him on the show. We usually speak to him every second week. And we are talking about a lot of issues. His most recent essay, which unfortunately I only published early this morning, is called What Constitutes a Just Labor Market? Naturally written by Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. Good morning, Professor. How are you, sir?
Fine. Good morning.
Well, good morning. The thing that's very interesting is you've been talking about labor markets and what is just and what is not just, how people who are aspiring to find employment are not always aware of their capabilities or their prospects in life. And then we're all born with different facilities. Some are born under a cloud of bias because of one reason or another, education, ethnicity, gender, whatever you can imagine comes into play. And yet, despite knowing so much about our circumstance, it seems we're very ignorant of our circumstance. How has this been able to, fester for all the years that we've been, you know, as a nation? And are we going through the same crisis in Europe and in Africa and in Asia? So what's the story here? Can we correct this, or is there no correction?
Well, I mean, we've always been a class-based society. As much as we like to cling to this fiction that we are a classless-based society. But the truth is, we're not class-based in that we are caste-like class, but we are class-based in terms of, you know, socioeconomic class. So, you know, it's based on income level and maybe in educational attainment, some level of culture. So that's your basis of class. In America, and there's also this concept of upward socioeconomic mobility. One can move from one class to another. And I suppose these days there's something called downward socioeconomic mobility as well. But I think what you're seeing in most recent years, you know, with the increased polarization of political dialogue, you're seeing a lot of discussion about social justice. You know, social justice means racial equity, gender equality, and to a certain extent, equality of outcomes. And that if certain groups have less than others, then that must be proof of systemic racism. Okay, so let's leave that question aside for a moment. The same people who talk about this need to achieve social equity and social justice, when it comes to the labor market, they don't seem to really care. What they do is they seem to be pursuing policies which, if anything, harm the middle class and actually leave groups that they claim to be advocating on behalf, to leave them behind. So when you're talking about policies that further the goals of globalization and result in harming the middle class, especially blue-collar workers, you know, among those that you're harming are precisely the ethnic minorities, the racial minorities that you claim to be a spokesperson for.
Well, we have a lot of people who espouse things that at the end turn out to be vacuous, meaningless, worthless words, where there's no backup with action. But the question remains, in a market economy of any kind, can we bring everyone to the same level? Can everyone earn the same amount of money? Can there be equality even if we educate everybody to the same level, who does the work of picking the fruit from the farm? Who? How do we pay? Or can everybody make the same amount of money?
So the rationalization has long been, not everybody earns the same thing, and in large part because people are free to make choices with regards to how they want to live their lives. If one wants to sacrifice and go to school for, let's say 4 years of medical school and 3 years of residency and then 2 years of fellowship, they're entitled to earn more money. Okay, they made the sacrifice. They delayed instant gratification. So those are the argument.
Isn't that where the equality ends? Because not every individual who may even aspire to become a doctor can become a doctor because they don't have the financial means to get there, and there may not even be enough scholarships.
Right. Not only do they not have the financial means to get there, they may not have the aptitude to get there. They may not have the natural endowments. So in that sense, there's no equality. And, you could presume, so people with those endowments will marry others with similar endowments. And they in turn, if genetics means anything, they will have children who have similar endowments, and they will then, because they are earning more money, they will be able to provide their children with opportunities that people born into less advantaged circumstances cannot provide. So then you're perpetuating inequities during time, and you're compounding these inequalities. That's where you begin to have a problem. So then you could say, we have a welfare state that maybe is aimed at leveling the playing field by providing more opportunities. The question is, what does that mean? Well, you could, I suppose, just give people checks, transfer programs. So those give them checks, transfer programs designed to give money to those who are born into disadvantaged circumstances. That's the easy way out, really. It's easier to actually pay for people's upkeep than it is to actually design programs that enable people to be self-sufficient or to develop their capabilities, as Marchesem would say. So basically, that's the debate that we're not really having. What should the welfare state be, and what kinds of programs should it pursue? Ideally, what you want to do is level the playing field. Okay, so you want to invest in educational programs for people who are born in disadvantaged circumstances. Maybe they should have lower cost college opportunities so they too can become members of the middle class. Maybe we should invest in economic development, investment that creates opportunities for people to become self-sufficient as opposed to becoming dependent on the state. That's the debate we, to a certain extent, we had during the 80s and the 90s when we're talking about welfare reform, but we've not gotten back to that. Now it's just easier to say, okay, you're poor. Let's throw you a bone. Here's a program. Let's move on. Those of us in the elites will continue to become prosperous and rich.
So how do we bridge, for example, if you have an individual who may not have the financial means to go to a higher educational platform so that they can end up with a job that would pay them more than they may have thought they could before, but then how do we afford the education? Can we afford to pay for teachers and institutions that will perpetuate something better than we have at present? Or do we need the strata of difference in order to maintain our economy? Is any economy actually egalitarian? Everyone has the same opportunity?
I think some economies are more egalitarian in that sense than others. we have a federal system of government where education is paid for at the local level based on property
yeah.
taxes. So if you live in a community where property taxes are low, because property values are low, you know, you're not going to have the same school system as, you know, say, you know, Short Hills, New Jersey, or Scarsdale, New York, where, you know, Chappaqua,
right.
where property values are extremely high, and the result is you have a higher tax base. Now, those schools can afford to pay their teachers better, and because it's safer to work there, more teachers want to work there than in inner city Newark, for example.
Correct.
So I mean, that's in that sense, you perpetuate those inequalities. You could, I suppose, fix the problem if you got rid of local funding for schools and basically had the state government pay for education across the board, giving out to school districts funds based on their population size and their population density. So, you know, that way each school would get according to its needs, so to speak, but there'd be more equity in the system. That's a political fight.
Even that picture seems to be inequitable or not equitable. Like, for example, can they afford to expend the same amount of money in Utah as we can in New York or New Jersey or Mississippi or Alabama? Isn't there a difference there as well? So are we going to create a society of people who don't have the educational background because the state can't afford it? Can it be a national program, or is that asking too much?
That would be, I suppose, if you want to take the view that citizens of one state are not equal to citizens of another state, and somehow violates the 14th Amendment, then you're basically talking about eliminating the federal system as we've known it, and then basically having centralized government in Washington make all decisions for all the states. States are relegated to provinces, and so are the school systems. Again, that's going to be a political fight. There's no basis in the Constitution for doing that.
So is our dynamic that we've created from the time of independence, which is pretty much a copy of what happened in the UK, in the United Kingdom, were we lazy? Should we have thought of something more? Could we have created a different dynamic, a different economic dynamic for the populace? Or are we the best in town, so to speak? On Earth, we may be the best institution in the world. If you can go to Harvard, and if you go to Yale and Princeton and places like that. But not if you go to a 2-year college. That's not going to get you very far. Not in today's world.
It probably gets you into the middle class because a 2-year college is to provide a certain level of vocational training. People become techs, hospital technicians and, you know, dental technicians and even nurses. There are other kinds of things that they can become. Then if people go to vocational school, I suppose they can, you know, become appliance technicians and other things, decent paying blue collar service jobs.
Well, that makes sense because I overlooked that. That's a very good point, because not only can the state help you or a community help you wherever you live up to a certain point, but it's also up to the individual. Even if they train as a nurse or as a technician, they can still go to school while they're working too, right?
Well, that's what the community college system is predicated on, this idea that, you know, people come from homes that are not necessarily wealthy. They're not going to go away to school. They're going to live at home. that maybe if we were working at the moment and going to school at night or going to school around the edges of the day, and they do the best they can. Sometimes if they can, they can go move into a four-year college and move up the ladder in a different way. The idea is that you have to have the infrastructure in place that allows people to have that kind of opportunity. Yes, you are putting the onus on the individual. You are saying, in effect, you are responsible for your own circumstances. You are responsible for how you're going to live your life. And you are basically responsible for your own fate. If you choose to not better yourself, then don't complain to everybody else in society that you have less than the other guy. The onus is basically placed on you. And that's part of a rationalization which allows those who are men among the very wealthy set to basically keep their wealth. To say, but I'm entitled to it. I work for it. I was handed down to me through hard work somewhere along the line. And you don't have the right to take it away, but you have opportunities before you. Now, the opportunity is not the same, obviously. If you, you know, somebody who is guaranteed a place at Harvard because they went to Aunt Phillips or Andover Academy, then, you know, they are going to be in a better position than somebody who graduates at the top of their class in public school and goes to, you know, a good public university like SUNY Binghamton. SUNY Binghamton graduates do fairly well, but they may not they still not have the opportunities as the person who went to these fancy prep schools, was guaranteed a place at Harvard, was a middling student at Harvard, but belonged to the right fraternities and clubs, and was guaranteed a place on Wall Street as soon as they graduated, even with their C-plus average.
Absolutely. So those are the dynamics. But it also drives people from all over the world to come to the United States to have the opportunity to get the education and so on and so forth. But it's not like everybody who comes to the United States is coming in with thousands and thousands of dollars so that their kid can go to school here, even though it may be a sacrifice back in the home country, wherever that may be. But then what do we do about the menial work that needs to be done? Who's going to be cleaning the hotel rooms? Who's going to be cooking? Who's going to be baking? Who's going to be making the dresses and the clothing that we buy? There's a difference in everything. Not everybody's walking around with a $10,000 watch.
Yes, there will be always a need for people to do those things. The question is, do they have to be paid so poorly that they can't become decent members of the middle class? And I don't think anybody really has a good answer for that.
Like, for example, there are people who work in upstate New York picking fruit, whether they pick blueberries or strawberries or oranges. I don't know what they pick up there because I really haven't been in the farms up in upstate New York. But the point is, they're making menial wages. Many of them live in like a lean-to somewhere with maybe 20 other guys, and everyone's trying to make a living. Why don't we raise the cost of blueberries more than what we're paying now? Because these people are going to have a very, very difficult time, if at all, to climb out of their economic straits. And if we can't afford it, so we can't afford it. So we don't have to buy apples. Is that going to be the end of the? It's not going to be the end of our day.
I think the question is, if you are, nobody's really addressing the question of, if you want to talk about social justice, let's talk about what does it mean to have a just economy and a just labor market. Nobody's addressing that question. Nobody asks.
No,
nobody really
no.
cares. They talk about economic growth, but nobody really cares about a just labor market where everybody has an opportunity to make a decent living and live above the poverty line. Everybody has an opportunity to develop their capabilities and not be dependent on other people. And everybody has an opportunity to work, but not be exploited by their employers because they have no choice but to work for low wages in order to eat.
Right.
And nobody's talking about that. We talk about
Why?
These wonderful programs to pay for this, that, and the other, but we're not really talking about what is good for individuals in terms of, you know, enabling them to succeed. Why? Because I really don't think the politicians care. I think they care about themselves. They're very narcissistic, and they're now parroting the official party line, under the label that they happen to run for office on. And they're just not, they don't really care. The working class party, which is just the Democratic Party, doesn't seem to care about the working class anymore. They have been dismissed as Trumpy deplorables. And if that's the tone that you're going to take, then people are going to wonder if there's any real hope for achieving any kind of a just society. If basically politics is zero sum, in order for one group to benefit, another group has to pay the cost, and you can justify them paying the cost because they have been exploitive and discriminating against the group that benefits, then there's really no serious discussion, no serious political discourse any longer.
So if that's the dynamic that we're living in, which it is, how do we bridge that? Are we investing money in jobs that will pay people a higher wage so that they can, when they have children, they can better themselves because they have greater options in life? Or are they always going to be taking whatever they're offered because the employer doesn't want to pay an extra dollar an hour or $5 an hour or $10,000 more a year? Is that going to just destroy our economic dynamic, the way it works? Do we need to have all these different hierarchies in order to function?
Well, if you have an educational system that it basically is going to provide a serious education so that students can have the capacity to choose occupations in STEM, and then they are college bound because they have the foundations they got because of K-12.
Right.
Then you are creating opportunities for them to make decent livings, and it won't matter where they went to school, whether they went to SUNY Binghamton, they went to Harvard, Rutgers, or Penn State. But you know, these will always be the cream of the crop, regardless of which school they went to. But if you're talking about, you know, like the Bernie Sanders approach, free college tuition. So then we're going to water down our entrance requirements so everybody can have an education. So the value of your education, getting a college degree, so you can work at the Gap or be a barista at Starbucks, you're not really solving any problems. But you are rationalizing the status quo, which either one benefits you or maybe you have no control over.
Why is it that we're so gullible? You know, we hear our politicians espousing one thing or the other. They talk a good game. They don't deliver. So what is it that we're so enamored by their BS? It's vacuous terms which mean nothing. And they say one thing today, and tomorrow it's all forgotten. And yet we reelect these people back into office just because we remember their name. I mean, it's insanity.
Well, the electoral system is based on name recognition. That's what it means to be a front runner these days. Not that they've achieved anything, but they have name recognition, which means, you know, the unknown person who achieves red name recognition, they can become the front runner, even though they have less experience. So, you know, I think what you're seeing is people are not necessarily enamored by politicians. They're enamored by the scandals surrounding the politicians.
That's for sure.
That's what plays on cable stations, you know, 24/7. Mm-hmm. Plays well on the internet as well. But people are not really well read or versed in the issues of the day.
And why is that? Is that because we're too busy trying to earn a living? Are we that obtuse that we don't appreciate that there is more to this world than what we think we know, and we don't know it all? I mean, it's a learning experience every day.
Part of it is we're busy or trying to earn a living. Part of it is, and this is probably, I think, the larger reason, is we don't feel the system's responsive to us anyway. Why make a fuss over what they're saying? It doesn't mean a whole lot. We assume them to be lying no matter what. It doesn't matter whether you elect a Democrat or Republican. Joe Public Opinion's his lot or her lot, Jill Public Opinion's lot is not going to change that much, regardless of who's in office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see that, you know, we heard all kinds of things from Ocasio-Cortez, but he hasn't developed anything. Just incite riots in a lot of people because of different positions she takes. And there are others that are the same. They may not be as vocal as she or good-looking as she, whatever, but and may even have a better education, but he can get by. What is it that we're gravitating to? Are we doing things for ourselves when we elect people who don't do for us what they're expected to do? Because they talk a good game once they get into office. They seem to be empty-headed. They don't seem to have solutions. They just have glib talk. So when are we going to get the intellectuals like you to tell us how it can work?
Well, we have a lot of talk about, which I also think is a vacuous concept, well, our democracy, the threat to our democracy, blah, blah, blah. But real threats to our democracy begin when you have an electorate that really is ignorant of the issues. They don't know whom they're voting for, why they're voting for particular candidates. True democracy requires responsibility for your actions. And if individuals are autonomous, they have to be responsible for the actions they take. That means that they're going to have to be given the right of franchise. They have to be responsible for the decisions they made at the ballot box. And they have to own those decisions. So you have to know the issues that you're voting for. It's not just enough to base your decision on a 2-second soundbite in a campaign advertisement. Rather, you really have to study the issues to make an informed decision. That's what democracy really requires. That's why the ancient Greeks talked about in a real democracy, all the elders would come to the center of town and debate the issues of the day, and then they would vote.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, that's not very practical in a big society, in a big populous society. It worked if you narrow the scope of who's a citizen, who's eligible to be a citizen. So there are very few people who actually can participate. But that was the basic idea. We're representative democracy, which is basically the underpinning concept of a republic. What you're talking about is we elect people to represent us. But we should be responsible for understanding who is actually running to represent them, what they stand for, and why we're electing them. And if we haven't done that, then we're not really worthy of democracy because we don't understand what it means.
So is there anybody that's doing it the right way? It may not be in America. It may be in England. Maybe it's in China for all we know. Maybe in an African country. I don't know.
I think it's very far and few between. Maybe a couple of those New England towns in local elections are doing it better than we are. But it's just not happening the way it was supposed to. And it's worth pointing out. The framers of the Constitution were leery about democracy. They were very suspicious of it. They felt democracy degenerate into what they called mobocracy. So they tried to create a system which basically would not be democratic in the ancient Athenian sense, but would be a representative, which would remove democracy, you know, from the people, a step from the people, so to speak.
But that is the American policy, isn't it? That is America. That's the definition of what we created in America. Do people recognize that? That the public is not in control? And everything works on an incremental basis. It's not like we have a right.
You have a constitutional system. It's a separation of powers. It's called Republican government, small r. You have bicameral legislative process, so you divide power between the upper and one lower chambers. You know, and for some reason, people think it's an affront to their democracy when the Electoral College picks somebody contrary to the popular vote actually being greater for the person who lost. But that's not the system that was created. And again, the framers were very they didn't trust democracy, so they wanted to remove it from the people. So you go to the polls in New York, you select your candidate's party has signed up 27 electors, the opponent's party signs up another slate of electors based on the popular vote in New York. The winner takes all. The winning slate goes to the Electoral College. The losing slate goes home. That's where this winner take all came from, in terms of the Electoral College. You want to say it's unfair? Define fairness. It's fair if you're a minority and you happen to be concentrated in the electorally rich states. So then you have more of a voice than you would if you simply had one person, one vote across the country. Is it fair then that populous states, on the coast, the coastal elites get to decide, and people in flyover country don't? Well, that's a whole discussion, different discussion on what constitutes fairness. But this idea that we're supposed to be democracy, and you define democracy, is also contrary to what the Constitution says. If you want to rewrite the Constitution, I suppose that's a legitimate discussion to have. But I think what you're seeing now are many progressives basically are really opposed to the Constitution. They would like to throw it out the window. Because it kind of gets in the way of their particular agenda.
So it looks like we've been captured by this whole process, and the process is not going to change. Despite all the recriminations that we hear and the lack of opportunity and the lack of equality in our capacity, we're very ignorant. There used to be a time when we had discussion and you would hear brilliant people on television and on radio discussing issues, and it made a difference. People were aware and they were more engaged. And now we're so far removed from our politics, and we're being bought by words that mean nothing, and there's no return from the people we vote into office. And they're happy because they have a job, and they have all the attributes that come with it, money and fame and wealth and unbelievable stuff. And the rest of us, you know, it's like, it's okay. When did we accept all of this stuff? And why are we still so ignorant of what goes on in government? Does that help us? Doesn't it? I don't think.
It doesn't help us now. I don't know if it'll help us in the future. It makes some people feel better. Again, politics is about power. Who has power? Who gets what, when, and how? And basically, those who have power don't want to relinquish power. And I think you're seeing that clearly in the halls of Congress. It's like,
yeah,
if there is something called a bill that benefits all, you're never going to get bipartisanship, because there will always be the feeling by the, say, the minority part, I don't want to give the majority party a win. But if it were beneficial to the minority party, more so, then the majority party is not going to vote for it, because that would give the minority party a win. We can't have that.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't want to...
So how do we balance that? Because we have opposing sides. Because some have an interest this way, some have an interest the other way. And how do we mitigate the issues that are evident? You know, lack of capacity, lack of equality, lack of opportunity, and so on and so forth, where some have and some don't. So can we rise above it?
I suppose you can try to overcome it as best mm-hmm. as you can. I suppose, you know, Mao Zedong, you know, had his war on intellectuals, and he basically supported
yes.
them. That's one way of achieving
yep,
equality.
He did.
Khmer Rouge did pretty much the same thing. If you can't redistribute brain cells, I guess you just kill off the intellectual class. So everybody is basically brought down to the lowest common denominator. That's one approach. I don't think it's the best approach, but that's one approach that dictators seem to like engaging in. Otherwise, you're really talking about, you have to ask the question, how can we make, you know, base just work, you know, like working as a barista, such that that those who are being serving as baristas are members of the middle class, and that they can feel good about what they're doing. If they earn a respectable wage that enables them to support themselves and their families, then they can actually become members of not only the middle class, but they can become members of civil society. They are autonomous. They feel better about themselves, and they're more likely to engage in civic affairs and participate in civic matters, become citizens in a larger sense. They are more likely to vote than those who earn poverty wages. So, you know, if the question is, how can we make them members of the middle class? Well, one way is to give their work. The traditional way of doing that was to enable them to become members of unions. Unions, because they would fight for higher wages, were also fighting for the dignity of their workers. That's how the middle class was born in the United States. Because factory workers in the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, these people were not earning respectable wages. They were earning poverty wages. And basically that was slave labor. And it was the union that brought respectability to the work that factory workers were doing. And then through time, we came to the conclusion, since they are now members of the middle class, these factory workers, they must, by definition, be more skilled than somebody pumping gas down the block. It's not clear that they were more skilled. They work in the assembly line. But we thought they were because their wages were higher.
Right. We thought they were. But so, like, it was a Henry Ford. Was he the benevolent guy that said, hey, the way I understood his concept was, I need to pay my workers a good enough wage so that they can afford to buy the cars that they're building. And it worked. So they were earning more money.
It worked in part.
No?
It worked in part.
That's right. It didn't work 100%.
It didn't work 100% because he never pays the workers the full wage they were supposed to get, because he was a moralist who hired his guards to go into their neighborhoods to see if they were drinking, carousing on Sunday afternoon. If they were, he docked them.
Yeah.
So a lot of the people didn't get the full wages he promised them. But the idea was there. If he paid a higher wage, they would become members of the middle class. They could buy the Model T Ford that they were building. His fellow industrialists thought he was crazy. I mean, what do you mean pay mm-hmm. workers something livable? That's absurd.
Right. Well, what about now when there's a movement for a lot of places that are not unionized to become unionized, and yet you've got billionaires, trillionaires, who don't want to pay more. So they don't want to pay the baristas more money. It used to never cost more than a dollar for a cup of coffee. Now you could spend $5 for a cup of coffee. And most people wouldn't even bat an eye. But why is it that we're not paying? What's the problem here? Why won't we let people become unionized? What's the problem? Is it going to raise costs? A big company going to be losing money if their members are unionized?
Well, they may lose some money. They may raise their costs to a certain extent. I think the real issue is it basically takes away control to a certain extent from employers, and they don't want to give that up. They want to control their workers as best as they can. You're basically giving workers some semblance of voice and mm-hmm. maybe some semblance of monopoly power. You're actually giving them the ability to bargain for better wages because you can always hold the strike as a threat, credible threat. And if you don't reach an agreement, then for collective bargaining, then you can walk out.
Okay.
So that becomes something employers don't want to do. Even the most progressive employers, the guy who was CEO of Starbucks, he claims to be progressive. As does the CEO of Amazon, you know, who owns the Washington Post.
Yeah. Well, Amazon. What would happen if they became unionized? And they did have the ability to strike because they maybe wanted more money. Why would that unravel, or will it diminish the capacity of Amazon to function? Because wouldn't Amazon, in order to pay its workers more, give them cause prices to rise?
May have to rise, or profits may be less. So, you know, maybe it's one less yacht that Bezos will buy. I don't know. But the truth is, it's not going to result in business slacking off because, you know, people, most consumers seem to enjoy the convenience of buying online. So I just don't see that happening. People, you know, Starbucks has its market for people who like Starbucks coffee. They're not all of a sudden going to go to Dunkin' Donuts for coffee because if they were going to do that, they would have done it a long time ago, where coffee is still probably a dollar.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess you can go from McDonald's at one price and Starbucks at another and Dunkin' Donuts at another. And I'm sure they all have different prices. So, I guess that's part of the panache, and I guess that's the marketplace. It just doesn't seem that we can change any of this. It's like it's static. It's in cement. It's never coming out. And I don't understand the rationale from Bezos. Not wanting his company to be unionized. I don't see why it would hurt him in any way. And I guess, well, it's his money, so he wants to make as much money as he possibly can, and he shouldn't have to lose money because he wants to set up a different system to give people greater power in their employment opportunity. it's a big responsibility for him too, I guess. You know, if he pays his staff more money, then I guess they could have more children, or they have greater opportunity. It could lift the whole nation, couldn't it? If we're more educated.
Well, I think it'd be better to think in terms of an efficiency wage if you were to pay his workers more. And you know, my understanding of some Amazon companies, because they're fearful of unionization, have raised their starting wages. So there are Amazon plants that are basically starting their workers at $18-19 an hour now. So, I mean, it's not great, but it's an improvement, I suppose. These are basically your new middle-class jobs. But if you paid even more than that, it's an efficiency wage. People will feel better about working at Amazon. And that, because they feel better about, they will be more productive. If they're more productive, then ultimately Amazon makes a bigger profit. And the truth is, other employers will follow suit and do exactly the same thing. They can achieve efficiency. I think what you're seeing is the perverse side of the efficiency argument. Employers know that it would be the wise thing to do to pay an efficiency wage. They're afraid to be the first to do it, but for fear that they'll lose customers to the competition. But so if you have a state mandated minimum wage, that takes away that pressure. If you have unionization, then you have, you know, pressure for non-unionized plants to raise their wages too. So usually what happens, you know, uncovered industries end up raising their wages in response to what's happening in covered plants, because there's competition for workers. So you basically, that's why you have the opposition to these things, even from companies that have been traditionally ununionized. They don't want, they're fearful of the competition for them, that they'll be forced to raise their wages anyway. This is what's going on. And from their standpoint, obviously, if you are limited in terms of where you're going to get this money to pay them, either it's going to come from raising the prices, or it's going to come from the diminution of the profits that are going to your shareholders. Now, let's go back to raising prices. Some people are going to say, and at least the economic model will predict, that's inflationary. And my response to that is there's something called good inflation and something bad inflation, sort of like good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. You know, if as a result of raising wages, prices go up a little bit, I think that's good inflation. We want wages to go up. We want people to be able to buy more. And that spurs prosperity throughout the economy. If you use the inflation argument as a weapon to prevent people from getting better wages, then you're not doing the economy any great favor down the road.
I'm sorry, you're not doing the economy what?
Any great favor raising down the road.
I see. I got you. Okay. And why are people averse to that then? Why would big companies be averse to good inflation? How does that benefit them?
They're averse to it because they don't want to pay the workers more.
But can't they compensate for that? Is it coming out of their pocket, really?
They can compensate for it the way they traditionally compensate for, by raising prices. If they can't raise prices because it's a competitive market, then that means their profits will be slightly lower. What they give to shareholders will be less. Or maybe they don't have to earn 50 times what the line worker is. They can earn 10 times what the line worker is and still be making a lot of money.
Absolutely. So have we become greedy in this whole process because we've gotten away with it for so long? There used to be a time when the guy that was cleaning up your floors, you know, in your office, he got one price, but then the company boss only got maybe, I don't know, 50 times more or 30 times more in salary, and now it's out of whack.
We have become greedy over the last four decades or so, and I think there was a shift in terms of the values of corporate America beginning in the, I'd say, the late 60s, early 70s, and it actually begins with a memo that Lewis Powell is head of the American Bar Association. He wasn't on the Supreme Court yet, but he was a prominent attorney, corporate attorney, who basically talked about how it was important for employers to start putting their workers in their place. And, you know, they need to take a hard line against their workers, not only in the companies that they were running, but also in public policy too, in the halls of Congress, to get laws that were favorable to businesses and somewhat anti-worker, because, you know, otherwise the social programs that were being enacted by the Democrats, the Great Society, War and Poverty programs, they were going to do damage to what he called the business interests. So it really begins with that infamous memo, you know, as to whether he mellowed or not, I don't know. And I think one of the questions that is not adequately addressed during most confirmation hearings to the Supreme Court is how a future justice will rule on a number of cases addressing worker rights and the relationship between workers and their employers. Those issues seem to be sidelined. Again, if you're talking about, you know, social justice and things of that nature, that should be a concern too. Not just, I don't want to belittle this, not just whether a woman's right to have an abortion would be protected. I mean, I happen to think that the Supreme Court ruling in Dobbs is the most disastrous decision that they could have handed down, but that's a whole different topic. Mm-hmm. But there are other issues that needed to be addressed, and they weren't.
Well, it's very interesting. I remember when prices for the, I guess, the CEOs of major corporations like the automobile industry, they went ballistic, and Volkswagen and Mercedes and BMW and the Italian cars and the Japanese cars, they weren't paying that much. But out of I guess the horror that they looked like they were pawns of a system that was out of whack, they raised their prices too. And it caused everybody to raise the differences between our society. So it changed our society on a worldwide basis. This was unbelievable what ended up happening. And yet the people at Mercedes-Benz were very happy with what they were getting before. It's insanity. So why could we do that and not change the dynamic now? What's holding us back this time? Because over there we did it for the elite, but now it would mean doing it for every man, every woman.
Well, what you won't do for the elite, you're not willing to do for the masses.
Correct.
Especially when the masses are considered by the elite to be the deplorables. You know, there's just no. The short of it is your political parties are not representing whom they used to represent. I mean, you know, I think at the beginning in Reagan's presidency, you had this group of Democrats who became Reagan Republicans, Reagan Democrats. They were blue-collar workers. They shifted to the Republican Party because of the social issues gripping the nation, you know, particularly the war in Vietnam and the fighting in the streets and the rioting, they moved over to the Republican Party. And the question was always, would they remain with the Republican Party? In some cases, they did not. They became independents, and they sort of left that wing of the party. When Bush, you know, your East Coast liberal, really spoke to the class more than anybody else, you know, really didn't seem to understand anybody. But, you know, he gets, I guess his claim to fame was nouveau riche. I mean, he should be elected because he's a member of that social class that his turn it is to run the country. And then they moved to Bill Clinton because he seemed to speak their language. But they never really realigned themselves in the Democratic Party. They just sort of de-aligned themselves from both parties, and they became independents. And now they seem to be, it's not clear which party they support. Many of them did, in fact, vote for Barack Obama in 2008 and then again in 2012. But they seem to have moved over to Trump in 2016 because he appealed to them or spoke their language to a certain extent. Not fully, because he didn't really deliver any promises he made to them. But he did speak to the fact that they were dispossessed by the global economy, and that nobody was really addressing their concerns. And then when you have the Democratic Party, who's supposed to speak for the working class, and the candidate says, I'm going to put you out of your work if you elect me. I'm going to shut down the mining operations, things like that, which is precisely what Joe Biden seems to have done. Then you have the political parties are in flux, and the alignments are out of whack to a certain extent. Now the working class are aligning with Republicans who couldn't care less about them and their plight and the, where they wind up, and you have the Democrats who seem to want to more focus on the elites. Now, the truth is, if you want to talk about green energy, a lot of these jobs are probably not going to pay as well as jobs in fossil fuels. That's something that the Democrats have not addressed adequately. And whether they will allow for unionization is still an open question.
Unbelievable. Literally unbelievable. Well, what a great way to end an hour. Certainly a learning experience. This is something we could probably talk about forever and ever. And learn something new every day. So any last words? I thought this was brilliant. I'm just like astounded how much you were able to put into this hour. Fantastic.
I have nothing to add at the moment.
Well, it's been brilliant, and I'll be listening again, because I'm sure there's a lot that I missed. Thank you very, very much. All the best to you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, there we have it. None other than Orrin M. Levin-Waldron, socioeconomic research scholar. And I hope you'd consider, if you didn't listen to the broadcast, you will consider reading and or rereading What Constitutes a Just Labor Market. Bear with me one moment. I got a message here from the hospital that's overseeing whatever ails me, and it's so much. And I need to respond. One second. One second here. All right. All right, so I think I was able to get that off. And so that was my response there. In the meantime, let me just quickly look here and make sure I have everything in place, because I'm not quite sure myself. Let me look at one other thing here. I'm waiting for, should be getting a call from Nader Sayers. So we'll find out in a moment. I've got to look up his number, and I wasn't prepared to look up his number. And bear with me a moment here. Let me see if I can find that number. Bear with me a second. I should be able to maybe do it this way. 1 second. Okay, now we're going to have to do this differently. I left a message for Danielle, so we'll get her later at 12 when we get off the show. And let me see if I can get this done. Bear with me a moment. Okay. All right, let me see if I can get Mayor Sayers again. All right, we're going to dial him up in a moment and see if we can get him. And if not, then we'll just move on, but I'm not sure. He might be busy on something, and I had not realized it. Bear with me a second here. No, it looks like it's him calling now, but he's faster than I am.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Mayor Sayers?
I'm doing good. Nice to be on the show, especially on a Wednesday. We usually get on a Friday, so this is a little special, but appreciate being on.
Well, just your being on is special. And you've accomplished quite a bit in the last few weeks, and yet you've been going steady and doing much more than ever I imagined. There's something very unique about your demeanor, which I find very compelling. And what I find compelling is that even though we can define you as a politician, which is an undefined term, and it keeps changing as we go from year to year to year, and from one regime after another. There are always constant changes. But what I find really compelling about you is that you're involved, you're engaged, you're active, you don't shrink away from issues. Where did you get this sort of demeanor? It is so antithetical to the particular political character that we find today. We hear a lot of vacuous words that are meaningless, that do nothing, that say nothing. Supposedly, people buy into a lot of these phrases that seem that they're infused with rationale and purpose and meaning and result, and yet we find that most of it is worthless. It's as if they never existed, and yet you rise above it all. I don't know how you do that. Where did you get
that? But
thank
you very much. Thank you very much. Genetics from my mother, God bless her.
Genetics.
You know, quite a woman. She's always taught us. You know, my father passed away when I was only about maybe 11, 12 years old in 1965. And my father raised 8 kids and really early on in life taught us, you know, how urgent and important it was, you know, to respect each other, to value everyone's opinion, to work hard, to achieve all we can, and to be honest and sincere with yourself and with others. And growing up in that atmosphere for me, especially in Southwest Yonkers, I think I said the story. I mean, there was a time when for me, you know, to pay my school lunch in elementary school actually shining shoes in downtown Yonkers by the waterfront. So, you know, you learn the importance of hard work. You learn, you know, as an immigrant, wanted to be respected and understood early on that to be respected, you got to respect. And, you know, so it's that upbringing. And, you know, being an educator, you know, for my entire life practically, worked with many children, you know, that were disenfranchised and English language learners and special ed students. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so for me, I grew up my entire life, my career, you know, with a value system instilled in me to respect people's needs and try to address them. So although I serve as an assemblyman, honestly, I see myself, you know, earlier you mentioned politicians. I really see myself as an advocate. I see myself as someone who, you know, took on a responsibility, took on a position, really not because I wanted to be a politician. You know, people that know my history always advocated for more school funding, especially for the Yonkers schools, always advocated for enhanced services, protecting people that are disadvantaged, the senior population, people that are really having a tough time for whatever reason. And that's what I focus on. That's what I gear my level of activity is not really because of the role I play as an assemblyman. My role and my activity has been this way for many, many years. Anybody that has known me, whether it's community service organizations, civic organizations, governmental, hospitals, educational, you know, God knows I served on all that. And I did it because I cared. I did it because, you know, I felt I can make a difference. And looking back, you know, I'm thankful
I
have.
But that's really the point. It seems that you're able to discern not only your own qualities and your own upbringing and the values that you were raised with and the hard work that it took for you to rise even above your own means at the time and the circumstances of your family and the immigrant society that you came from and the language that you spoke and the ethnicity and the religion and everything imaginable under the sun. And yet you're able to eclipse all of this and still see the need in people who are very different than you are today. But you were them at one time in your life. The fact that you remember is so compelling to me because I find very few people with the same demeanor, the same attitude, the same drive, and the same desire to fix things because they can. And you seem to captivate me that way. And I can't imagine, well, if there are people who don't think and don't watch and don't see what's going on, then, you know, then they're oblivious. But, you know, I find that I can only learn by studying. And I study people, not because I look to undermine them. I look to study and find the qualities that they bring forward. And to me, that's a lesson. You are a lesson, a living lesson in a city like Yonkers that rarely has had people like you, your intellect, your capacity, your interest, and your drive. It is absolutely astounding. And, you know, maybe it sounds like a sermon, but it's not. It's just so rare. And I find it so breathtaking. So tell me, what have you been focusing on of late? What are you paying attention to?
Well, a lot has been happening, you know, recently within the last 2 weeks, very happy that Governor Hochul has signed three of my bills. I mean, some legislators, you know, stay in their capacity for years and barely have any significant legislation that they've passed or sponsored, you know, that have their fingerprints on it. And, you know, I've been very fortunate, you know, especially as an attorney. I understand the law. I know how to research. I know. And as a communicator, you know, I make it my business whenever I talk to individuals in all levels, in all capacities, to find out what's on their mind, to find out what the issues are, what their concerns are. And very often, not to stop there, my next phase is say, well, if there is an issue, what do you think is wrong about it, and why is it wrong, and does it have to do with state policy, local, federal, And what do you recommend we do to change it? How do we make it better? Mm-hmm. I did that as a school principal, and I got some of the best recommendations over the years from speaking to children, to kids, and to parents and
yeah.
teachers. And we made changes based on that. So similar in the assembly, you know, I speak to people and say, well, tell me what's on your mind and why is it wrong? And to that extent, we've been able to make a lot of changes. Governor Hochul, during the last 2 weeks, has signed three of my legislative bills. Mind you, I took office in November of 2018. It was a vacant
yes.
seat when Senator Shelley Mayer became state senator. So
mm-hmm.
I took over before January 2019. And in that short time, I was looking at, my track record as far as when it comes to bills and sponsorships and legislations in Albany. And as a prime sponsor bills, this means these are special bills that every session an assembly or senator puts in. I have 172 that are prime sponsored bills. And then I was looking deep to see, well, what did I co-sponsor during that time? Now, mind you, this is
right.
about 3.5 years, 2,787 bills that I've co-sponsored,
wow.
you know, other bills. So, you know, to your point, my track record as being a very, you know, not only motivated but upfront legislator that really gets involved with the legislative process, gets involved with the constituent aspects of my role as an assemblyman. You know, our office is really twofold. One is to be in Albany, represent the best interest of Yonkers and New York State, and really pass legislation that provides, you know, good motive type of change. And the other
mm-hmm.
part of it is legislative services. And I have an office in Albany for that, and I have an office in Yonkers. Yonkers is really more constituent services. Anybody
yeah.
that has followed my office from the day I took office till today, we've been extremely active, you know, with constituent services, with vaccinations. You know, we lobbied to get
mm-hmm.
the vaccination site in Yonkers. We were the first to really push the state to make sure they recognize Yonkers as an area that needed to be addressed immediately with the COVID-19. We
mm-hmm.
immediately took action on the monkeypox. When people
yeah,
were looking
mm-hmm.
at it, we reached out to the state. We reached out to the health department and said, hey, this is before New York State, you know, recognized and acknowledged it as an emergency, as something they got to react to, and the feds followed up. But we took the
mm-hmm.
action. We listened to what constituents and people that reached out to us, including yourself, Hezzy, and said, hey, this is a serious problem. Why are we lagging behind? Why are we not concerned about making sure we can stop the spread? This is the type of leadership, the type of commitment that a legislator should show in any position, whether they represent
mm-hmm.
local or state or federal. And that's why from my end, you know, I'm very happy, very proud of my staff, my office. We do a weekly outreach to our constituents.
Right.
You know, we attend many events. We recognize many organizations. I was looking at the amount of organizations we funded this last 2 years in Yonkers, from police training
uh-huh.
and grants and facilities and involved in education, involved in community-based organizations, celebrating cultures, diversity. You know, it makes you proud. It makes you proud to really, you know, represent your city and your community in the best way possible. That's, you know, as they say, that's what we're all about, and that's what a legislator should be doing in their job.
Well, that's what you're all about, but not everybody does the same thing. Not everyone has the same experience. Not everyone has the same history.
And, you know, and by the way,
and
the,
you know,
governor,
go ahead.
The governor was in Yonkers 2 days ago and, you know, signed a whole legislative package of bills that really provides, you know, benefits to seniors, home first-time home buyers, disabled individuals. You know, when a disabled individual renovates in their house and puts handicap accessibility or tries to make repairs, you know, that makes necessary modifications. This keeps seniors and disabled people really at home. We learned what happened the last number of years with COVID and senior citizen centers. And, you know, we all experienced that. Many of us lost family members and loved ones. So the last number of years, we've been pushing legislation, Hezzy, that really focuses on keeping older people at home. And we know that when people can stay in their homes and we can provide legislation where family members can provide home care services for people to stay at home, we can keep them safe at home, we can give them incentives on taxes and other rebates, bar rebates and others. This is legislation that, in my opinion, is proactive. It protects seniors. It protects low-income people. It gives people opportunity to stay in their homes, even middle class. You know, the tax cuts, the rebate checks, in addition to SPAR, you know, that, you know, billions of dollars that were given back to middle class, to property owners right here in Yonkers, where the average family got $1,000 back. This is in addition to SPAR, you know, is really, you know, in my opinion, proactive. And sometimes when you do these type of activities and you bring about relief, you always hear people that are complaining. People that, you know, complain, well, maybe not enough is done and maybe, but I always say, you know, to individuals, hey, you know, stop being negative and start, you know, recognizing, even if it's small steps. And some are major steps, in my opinion, but even if it's small steps and you're making this improvement, you know, get on board. Everything shouldn't be political. Everything shouldn't be Republican, Democrat, and everything shouldn't be – that's what divides us. And, you know, I watch what's happening on the federal level, on the state level. I see the division that has divided our nation, divided our community, where, you know, people, rather than recognizing, hey, you know what, even though it's a Democrat governor that sponsored these last bills dealing with seniors and disabled, you know, let's compliment. Let's say, hey, that's a good thing. Exactly. It's fine to say, yeah, that's a good thing, but, you know, I'd like to see more. I can respect that, you know, and we all want to see more. But at least you want the system to go back to a normality as it should be, where legislators, you know, complement, whether local, state, or federal, complement good initiatives and continue to criticize if they want more or they feel maybe doesn't go far enough. And that's where, you know, government at all levels has a serious, in my opinion, default, you know, and I try to do my share by reaching out to the other side of the aisle. I negotiate all my three bills that were signed by the government, by the governor, were passed in the Senate and the Assembly unanimously. And you know why? Because I reach out to the other side of the aisle and I say, well, this is a beautiful bill that deals with holding utility companies responsible to make sure they restore energy in a proper way, to make sure there's a plan of action in case of an outage or a storm or a hurricane, to make sure that police, fire, you know, have adequate service to react to emergencies. And I go to the other side of the aisle and I speak to my colleagues and their leadership and say, hey, what's your issue with this bill? Well, there's something minor. Well, let's work on it, and we'll modify it. And then at the end of the day, when you get every single assembly member to sign on to a SAGE bill, you know, whether it's given back or taken away the expiration from gift cards, or in this case, passing legislation that allows government to relate to representatives in a gender-neutral language. For example, the governor signed my bill, and it really was brought upon when Governor Hochul became governor, and I looked at the Constitution in New York that relates to the, for example, the position of governor, and all it has was the governor, his and him, and it was all masculine. And I said, well, now we have a female governor, so something as simple as saying, you know what, it should begin to reflect language that relates to the position. For example, the governor shall, and the governor decides, and the governor's initiative, rather than him or her, is he, you know, so something like that. Again, everyone across the aisle and including my party vote. And the third one that was signed is the diaper tax relief bill. You know, New York State, you know, many municipalities, even in Yonkers here, there's nearly a 5% tax on diapers, not only infant diapers, on adult diapers, people, the older people, people with disabilities that relate and need. And in talking to people at the national and the local diaper banks where there's volunteers, they were basically crying out as far as how many mothers and how many people that really couldn't afford diapers, having a dry, clean diaper on a baby. And we know the health factors, the discomfort of diaper rashes and illnesses when diapers are not changed, you know, and it really causes, you know, a serious, you know, problem with a mother and a child when a baby's crying and doesn't have, you know, a clean, dry diaper. So this legislation now permanently forces and makes sure that municipalities and cities and counties across the state don't tax diapers. And that's really a follow-up to the, you know, the tax exemption on gasoline. Finally, gas prices are going down. That was very alarming to see gas reach the $5 for regular and so forth and even more. And now finally, it's in the low $4. Very soon, in my opinion, it's going to go below $4, you know, which is still costly. But like I said earlier, Hezzy, you know, small steps that show concern, that bring about relief, you know, should be complimented, not criticized. And too often, again, people are critical even when something on its face value is positive. You know, we still, for political purposes, criticize.
I think what I find compelling, though, is that you recognize these are the foibles of humanity wherever you go. It doesn't make a difference what country, what city, anywhere.
Sure.
It's the way people are, and people are critical. But the way you seem to eclipse these issues is by reaching out to others, and you build relationships that go beyond the dogma of one party or the other, or a third or whatever. The point is that by reaching out, engaging in conversation, trying to find an accommodation that represents Republican and Democrat, Democrat and Republican, in whatever is being expressed in legislation, that's the secret that you seem to have been able to bring to the equation, and most people still don't do that. And that division between the dogma, the political dogma, is undermining our nation, because it shouldn't be that difficult to be able to speak to someone on the other side of the aisle and find out what can be done. because I'm sure we can get a lot closer than we are, you know, on many issues. So what is it that causes people not to reach out? You would think that in politics, everybody would want to reach out.
Sure, definitely. Even on the federal level, I mean, I was happy that, you know, the president, you know, has his issues. And, you know, even in my role as a Democrat, but I consider myself someone, you know, who communicates with all branches of government, who communicates with all factions politically. You know, although I have a label as a Democrat, my relationship is across the board with my community at large, and I look and I tell individuals all the time, you know, I'm not always a rubber stamp for, you know, the party I'm affiliated with, whether on the state or federal level. You know, generally, you know, my philosophy and my way of thinking aligns itself more with Democrat principles, but at the same time, you know, I agree that what caused polarization and division in our country and state is the push by extremism on both sides of a political aisles, you know, to really push the nation either extreme left or extreme right. And in my opinion, our country, our state functions best when we are mainstream, when we try to represent the best interest of mainstream New York Yonkers of the nation. You know, with the president just recently, you know, signs a $280 billion CHIPS and Science Act legislation. You and I spoke about how we were caught off guard over the last couple of years with COVID-19, with most of our research and health and science and CHIPS were coming from China and elsewhere across the world. And we recognized at the time, real quick, that, hey, that's a major shortfall, that we as one of the strongest reputable nations of the world, you know, weren't producing our necessities right here at home in the USA, made in America, the old theme. And we were caught off guard. You know, we were bickering with the Chinese and others. Meanwhile, we had to rely on them for technology, for health supplies, for vaccinations. And that really, in my opinion, raised the red flag at all levels in our country. And we began to realize that we needed to invest in America. We needed to provide incentives to tell American companies, you know, make the chips here in America. We're going to give you an incentive. We're going to make sure by doing this, you know, we can secure our future. We can make sure that we're not dependent on anything foreign or, God forbid.
You know, what was interesting, about all that is that it was corporate America that was looking for a cheap way out to make more profit for themselves. And in doing so, they took America's prominence in so many fields of endeavor, and they shipped it abroad. And the fact that government is now removing those incentives abroad and enticing people to make the investments here is only going to help our security in many ways, educationally and financially and every other means. I guess one of the things that's been lacking is Wall Street has gone crazy, and they're doing it for themselves, because there used to be a time when the owner of a company was the one that made the investment, and all of a sudden it's the CEOs of companies that make it sound like they own the place, but they don't. And this is what's very interesting.
Terrible.
The dynamic has changed. Go ahead.
No, but, you know, with regards to this issue, you know, we do, you know, we see the inflation that has impacted us and continues to do so. and you see the cost of automobiles, you know, increase by 20-30%. People that are renting cars, you know, are paying when they used to pay 4 years ago for an average car anywhere between $300 to $400 a month. Now you're talking of $600 or more. I mean, in many cases, the prices have doubled. Chips are hard to come by for automobiles, for computers, for smartphones.
Right.
You know, this is all part of the reasons we have such a serious inflation going on. Many Americans can't even afford basics these days. You know, you look at, you know, the cost of going shopping where, you know, $100 can buy a family enough grocery. Now you walk in to ShopRite or any other business and $100 doesn't buy you much, you know, or the quantity of food is not the same. You know, people are, you know, exhausting their savings. That's why the level of frustration required that government, you know, reaches out. And that's why with some of the faults the president has, I'm glad, to me, as a concerned resident and watching what has impacted our nation the last number of years, this was major. That's why 17 senators, you know, went ahead with President Biden and signed off and passed this, you know, CHIPS and Science Act, which, you know, which really I think was long overdue. You know, this is the type of thing where when you start reaching out and getting representatives, you know, on both sides of the aisle to really work together, you know, even the infrastructure bill that has been lagging behind because of disagreement and politics, you know, the impact on our nation, on building roads and building schools and dams and promoting jobs really hinders everyone. People don't realize it. It hinders and impacts everyone, Democrats and Republicans and everyone in between. What people don't realize is, you know, they should reach out and demand from their legislators that they should be more proactive. They should, you know, collaborate more, cooperate more, because at the end of the day, the more you do more of that, the more positive results that come about. I've experienced it in my role.
What I find interesting is, and I didn't notice this before, but once I started to cover Yonkers, which is now about close to 25 years, I realized that Yonkers is really a melding of the different political theories that people ascribe to. And I think I best heard this once when it was a singing group, a brother and sister, and they ended up singing, and it turns out somebody said that there were a little bit of country and a little bit of rock and roll, and that seems to be the demeanor in Yonkers. Do you think that that helps your effort to be able to recognize that there's value in both sides of the political aisle, and therefore that there is a way to bridge it?
Well, that's a good point. You're right, Hezzy. Yonkers, you know, I often say when I'm in the state assembly and I, you know, communicate with many of my colleagues, assembly members from upstate New York, from western New York, from New York City, and I sense that legislators that come from areas that are, you know, mostly of one thinking, you know, their opinions are, you know, lean too much to that, and they don't understand the rest of the state, you know. So you're right. Like some of my colleagues out of New York City may represent areas that are extremely politically more to the left, right? So they don't make an attempt to really try to understand mainstream America, mainstream New York. And some of my colleagues that may represent areas in upstate New York or western New York, you know, honestly, mm-hmm. may be too much to the right, and I may look at them and say, come on, you know, you got to recognize what takes place in urban America and urban New York and Yonkers, and you're a little bit off. So, but to your point, I represent a city like Yonkers. You know, I consider ourselves, you know, more reflective of the entire state and the nation, because to your point, you know, you go to Yonkers, New York, and you find neighborhoods that may be, you know, for some too moderate. You find neighborhoods in Yonkers that to some may seem too liberal or too much to the left. And I'm in the middle of that. I communicate mm-hmm. with both ends, you know, and my role is to say, hey, let's look at the commonality. Let's look at what exactly. common interests we have, and how do we come to some consensus, come to some point where nobody feels hurt or left out, where everybody can join in and feel, hey, I can live with this. You know, when you talk about issues involving tenants and landlords, you know, some people are extreme one way or the other. My legislation was, how can we work out a system, a process, a procedure where nobody's hurt? Everybody can live and live mm-hmm. and be equitable. When you talk about, you know, affordable housing, what can we do to make sure we can build affordable housing while at the same time making sure that people that invest, the developers and the investors and the landlords, can also live with it and benefit? When you talk about, you know, different areas of government and different businesses, what can you do to bring in business, big business, like we did with UPS? When UPS came to yeah. Yonkers, mm-hmm. we were in the middle of it. We negotiated with UPS, with the community at large, with the city of Yonkers, with the labor unions, and said, well, how can we keep the jobs in Yonkers? How can we make sure we address, you know, the needs of the community when it came to traffic and noise and other potential concerns? And we came to a middle ground where we were able to say, hey, you know, we're enhancing the tax base of Yonkers. We're encouraging big business. But at the same time, we're working with the parties that could be impacted. When MGM mm-hmm. bought Empire Casino, yeah, we right. worked with MGM because we don't want to lose MGM. We wanted MGM to come into Yonkers, promote mm-hmm. thousands of jobs, good-paying jobs, but we wanted them to give more funds for education. We wanted them to work with the community. We wanted to make sure that they expanded their operation so that there was a concert hall eventually, that there was musical concerts and events and activities. So at the end of the day, it's a win-win for Yonkers. That's the type of action and legislative initiatives and thinking and mindset that people need to have, you know, and that's what I hope through my efforts and through this type of communication with your show, Hezzy, that we can, you know, disseminate and express to people, the listening audience, that, hey, this is what you should expect. Reach out, communicate. Well, I often say...
It's very interesting, though, too, that, you know, even though you represent Yonkers, by engaging, and you're on the board, also the waging board on the state level. I think
race and
wages.
Race,
yes. Yes. When you encouraged MGM and with the Empire City, not only were you managing the affairs of Yonkers, look at all the people that are benefiting from the Bronx who are going to be employed. And this is
of
what
course.
Escapes so many people. They don't go beyond. They don't search for a complete answer. And the complexity is too often missing. That's why I always find it a pleasure to talk to you, because you do give expression to all these things. Time. I mean, I forget a lot of things every day. But thank God there's another day to remember. So those are the things that matter.
But has he, you know, back to the president, you know, people don't realize part of his economic agenda, which again, you know, passed the Senate, the Inflation Reduction Act that lowers health care costs, millions of jobs in the clean energy sector. It cuts the country's carbon emission by 40% by 2030. People realize years ago when you said 2030, but that's like, you know, 7-8 years from now. So, you know, it's around the corner. And, you know, people say, well, is it real? You know, and I was one of those people years ago when people spoke and complained about, you know, the environment and clean energy and climate control. Honestly, you know, most of us looked at it and said, is this realistic and so forth? But really, we look at our Earth. We look at, you know, the emission problems that are causing the ozone layer and other situations to deteriorate. You look at the amount of storms and hurricanes and, you know, weather conditions that, you know, we really have an experience where years ago, oh, the storm of the century, now you're having two of these a year. You know, so at some point, you know, we needed to begin to address this. And I think, you know, from the state perspective and looking at the president's new initiative, you know, there's also an emphasis on there. You know, so, and then people don't realize, you know, we talked about small steps sometimes, lowering the cost of prescription drugs, you know, the impact on families, on seniors, you know, and then the president's executive actions to reduce gun violence. And I hear it all the time, people that are upset, well, you know, my right to own a gun and don't take that right away.
Thank you very much.
And I respect people's concern, you know, to protect their families, protect their businesses. But similar to bail reform, gun reform, you know, we always need to try to find ways, you know, to continue to fix things. So even if there was a good initiative and it made sense, what do you do to fix it? And that's the message I give to people, that, you know, things may not be perfect when you pass you know, bail reform, for example. Maybe the motive was good, but if violent criminals and people that are being let out of the court system and jails because of bail reform are committing crimes, then we need to look at it. What can we do to make sure that a repeat offender or violent criminal is not let out on the street? I mean, in Yonkers, we witnessed a few incidents where police officers were assaulted and hurt, and that's upsetting. That's upsetting, you know. So, you know, does it mean we hold our ground and say bail reform is good and we shouldn't modify? Absolutely not. I'm the first guy, as a Democrat, as a legislator, to say, you know what, we got to continue to fix bail reform. We got to make sure we give more discretion to judges. We got to work closely with law enforcement, as I have. I think my track record of providing training for Yonkers law enforcement, or providing capital funding, you know, for facilities that allows police and fire departments to train and deal with emergencies, is the type of action that is not only proper, but in my opinion, worthy. But that's
absolutely
what it's all about, Ezzy. That's what it's all about.
Definitely. That's exactly what it's all about.
Yeah.
So is anyone giving a course up in Albany, you know, about how it's supposed to be done, or is this only, thank goodness, you were informed by your family?
Well, just informed, but there should be more workshops, maybe. Maybe I'll put on my educator hat on, and, you know, for government, there should be more workshops, more training, really, for legislators. You know, in any profession, we do professional development, and maybe in government, similar to law and similar to healthcare, where doctors and lawyers and other professionals have continuing either legal education or medical, maybe there should be continuing governmental education, where government officials at all levels are given certain training, whether on a yearly or bi-yearly basis, where they should learn how to deal with constituent services, how to legislate policy, how to research, how to really initiate more dialogue, how to learn how to collaborate and work together with colleagues, especially on important initiatives that impact their locality, their county, their state.
How do we train how do we train the public who seem not to be aware of the and governance that we've adopted? This country has a set of rules and regulations. It's different in other countries. And,
Well, your show, your ability to be really, in my opinion, on target, on issues, on concerns, and then to disseminate the information similar to what you're doing through your show, your activity, your outreach, public relations outreach, and bring in speakers that speak about topics and issues, and really to encourage this dialogue. And my hope is, you know, through the discussions you and I have and the messages we put out as far as more collaboration and more legislation and more involvement that at the end of the day addresses the needs of the mainstream of the people we represent. You know, if that message is echoed and that message is disseminated and put out there repeatedly sometimes, where more and more people begin to recognize and understand that, yes, there is too much polarization. Yes, we as Americans, as New Yorkers, as Yonkerites, we should begin to focus more on who we are as a community, as a state, as a nation, and we as a people, what we need to do is focus more on what makes us common. And I often say this when I do international conferences on interfaith celebration, on peace, on coexistence. And my message is always, hey, no matter what religion, what culture, what ethnicity, what our preferences, we basically are all members of the human family. We're all members of what I consider the global society. And that really motivates us to be more open-minded, to respect each other for who we are, and really cherish and celebrate sometimes the differences, not in a negative way, in a positive way. I make it my interest, you know, to appreciate all religions, appreciate their celebrations, cultural celebrations, appreciate, you know, if someone has a difference, a value system, understand it and try to appreciate it for what it is and recognize that at the end of the day, 90% of who we are is common and our needs are common. Our health, our well-being, our family.
Why is it that we don't know that about each other? Maybe I know that I've learned a great deal because I've traveled the world. I've been on every continent, and I didn't go there for a week's vacation. I remember being personally invited to General Al-Haqdiya to Pakistan. I spent 2 months in Pakistan. I went from the south all the way up to Gilgit in the north, and I loved it. I loved the people. They were wonderful, and they were not my religion. They didn't look like me. It didn't matter. But you live with people, because how could you even try to hurt people? This is what I don't understand. And yet, if you're in any particular country, everyone's got their own little dogma, They hate this one or they hate that one, and yet I don't see why we have to go there, because I don't think it's a value. I'd rather find something wonderful about another country and other people, and say, hey, that's not that far removed from me, and it isn't. Because, like,
but
you said,
you're
we're
so
all
right.
Part of the human race.
Well, you know what? Unfortunately, you know, and I've studied, like you did, world history and the rise
yes.
of civilization.
Oh, we forgot that a long time ago.
Yeah, well, you know, I say for anyone who's in the educational process, no matter what profession, always be more globally oriented. Always, you know, people that go into the sciences and technology, you know, need to have a little liberal arts, a little social sciences, a little history and politics. No matter what profession, I always say, if you have an opportunity for some electives beyond your major, make sure you diversify your learning, because, you know, the more people are more aware of the world we live in, more aware of, you know, what makes up the world, you know, civilizations and cultures and peoples. And mind you, when you study history, Hezi, you know, it was intentional, you know, over the centuries and the decades, where people on purpose, you know, this whole philosophy of divide and conquer, where people intentionally went out to destroy people, destroy civilizations, you know, destroy cultures, you know, all for the sake of banner sometimes of religion, of ethnic, of pride, of other factors. And the last maybe 100 years, you know, it's turned into what I consider international global businesses, the oil industry, the defense industry, other lobby groups that really, you know, you watch them because of profits in the boardroom and decisions where sometimes international, regional conflicts were caused, people suffered, people were maimed and killed. You know, and when you study the world history and you understand, honestly, it's very hurtful when you see that people were destroyed, peoples and civilizations, because of big business. It's very hurtful. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, from my end, you know, it's always a mission, you know, to try to resolve a lot of that. My involvement, even something by reaching out to people in the sub-Indian continent that believed in the sport of cricket, right? And we established and helped them expand it in the United States, where now they have eight sport teams. You know, there's a lot of pride for the Southern Indian Peninsula, you know, with regards to a new sport that they appreciate. Even people that came and spoke about the need to expand yoga, for example, which is very therapeutic. It's, you know, it's something that I feel as an educator, you know, should be incorporated more into schools with social support services, addressing self-esteem and modification of behavior and stuff like that.
That's
that really impacts crime.
That thought actually would lend itself for people to explore a little bit more about cultures they don't know. But there's the baseline that would intrigue people is there. And that's what we forget to do nowadays.
But we did that with yoga. We met with the leadership, and some of them well-represented gurus, you know, that religious and other cultural leaders. And I've had, you know, really the privilege, and I was honored to be recognized as one of the international guest speakers, utilize my assembly office in Yonkers in New York State. I sponsored legislation, special resolutions, where now New York State recognizes yoga, the International Day of Yoga and so forth. And, you know, that information is disseminated all over the world, and it ties in to global collaboration, ties into interfaith dialogue, people representing every religion, that are on board, that are expressing the message of peace and dialogue and coexistence. And recently, you know, participated in something led by the Vatican, you know, the Seeds of Peace Organization, international. By the way, this year they honored the King of Jordan, King Abdullah and
Absolutely.
Queen Rania. Yeah, and I attended these events, and you know, for me, it really makes me feel good when you see that with all the negatives that is going on, at least there's many positive initiatives, many individuals that are pushing the positive aspects we're talking about, and we should never give up. You know, whether on your show, on the United Nations level, at every level.
The problem is that we pay too much attention to the negative, because that's incendiary and it drives people crazy. But it takes a lot more effort to say, look at what's been accomplished in Jordan and the king and queen, what they've accomplished, and the legacy of their father. It goes
on.
And if people read the history, then they would recognize it. But, you know, how many places would write something like that in today's modern world? But if you go to the Yonkers Tribune, you could find it there. It celebrates what was done. But people don't know it. And that's where the bigotry comes from. Because there's always something to mitigate that bias. And but that takes knowledge. So,
well,
you
and I
are
both. Yeah, you and I, Ezzy, we're both on board. We're, you know, I'm glad that we have this opportunity on a regular basis to communicate, and I think our listening audience know, with your experience and mine, you know, our ability
Absolutely.
To deal not only with local and state and national and even international, because at the end
mm-hmm.
of the day, the more the listening audience becomes aware, the more they understand, whether it's policy, legislation, the better informed they become, and the better informed they become, they can make better decisions. You know, when they go to the polls, there's a primary for Congress that's on August 23rd. There's general elections here in Yonkers and across the country on November 8th. People should know there's early voting. People have no excuses. There's paper ballots. There's absentee ballots. I mean, the process, you know, to get people involved, to get people to vote, to participate, this is the greatest aspect of democracy, Hezzy, the opportunity to have a voice, to speak up, to vote your mind, and get people to represent you that you believe in, people that best reflect your needs, your concerns, your views, and don't always base it on party politics. As I said earlier on the show, at the end of the day, you know, who we are is who we are, and who we are is based on our credibility, our track records, and no secret, I'm running for re-election this November. Again, I was again elected in 2018.
Thank goodness for that.
Well, and you know, but I'm proud of my track record. You know, again, when I look at
a good track record,
and we try to build on that. You know, and you never sit back
and you are
and say. You can't sit back and say, well, I had enough. Then you know what? Leave. I tell public officials, when you feel that you're at a point where you don't feel like going that extra mile for the people you represent, then you really should leave office. And politics honestly shouldn't be a career where people feel, let me just stay in office till I'm termed out or I can't run anymore. You know, when you're not effective, people should do the right thing and just leave. Or to seek office because, oh, I got to depend on politics and I got to stay and, you know, and receive a salary and whatever, you know, then shame on that individual. You know, my message to public officials, this should be a position of honor. And it's a position where people entrust in you a fiduciary duty to represent their best interest. And if you can't do that, you shouldn't be in that position.
Exactly. Unfortunately, we're going to need to bring this back up in 2 weeks' time when we talk again. Or are we on every week? I don't remember. Hopefully,
we can try weekly. The more, the better, Hezzy. Always a pleasure.
Exactly.
And again, thank you very much.
Because we're
going
to get cut off. All the best to you. Thank you for
what you
do. All the best. Take
best
care.
Best regards.
There we are, folks. We'll speak to you tomorrow because we've got to shut down before they shut us down. Take care and goodbye.
Oh, so there's 6.